Hello, and welcome to the Zeitgeist 19 podcast, curating the spirit of now through the lens of art and sustainability. Your hosts are Farah Piriya-Cohen and Elizabeth Zhivkova. Hi, and welcome back to Zeitgeist 19. Today we are diving into the world of immersive sound with Antoine Bertin, an artist whose work blends science, field recording, and deep listening. From Tate Britain to NTS Radio, Antoine's work invites us to rethink our sensory relationship with nature, particularly the sonic landscapes we rarely hear, like the depth of the ocean. From the sonic textures of the ocean to data-driven audio meditations, Antoine invites us to hear the world differently. I hope you enjoy this journey into sound, perception, and the hidden voices of our planet. Thank you so much for being here, Antoine. It's a pleasure to have you. Let's get straight into it. Your work blends science, field recording, and immersive experiences in such a unique way. What sparked your journey into sound art, and how did your background, like your training as a sound engineer or your time at London College of Communication, shape the artist you are today?
Hey, thank you. It's a pleasure to have this conversation with you and to be on the podcast together. Journey into sound. So I think I came to sound a little bit intuitively and a bit randomly also. What happened is my dad was always into music but never played an instrument, and when he was in his 40s started to play the guitar. And then as someone who maybe already had the budget to buy a different instrument and, you know, was excited about starting a new instrument, he bought a first guitar and then a second, and then he put the first guitar in my room because he didn't have space in his. And anyway, I had this instrument in my vicinity, and I, at the time, I was really into aquariums, like nothing to do, I thought nothing to do with sound or music at the time. I really remember this picture of seeing the guitar, the aquarium, and being into aquarium was a bit of a, was maybe around 12, 14 at the time, a bit of a lonely activity, you know. Not maybe, I found one person where I was studying that was also into fish, but we just basically hang out together and with nobody else. so music, it was like just came here into my room, and I just started getting interested into it. And through music, I met a lot of people, made new friends, you know, and it was a completely other life. So I think I came into sound more as a way to open into something new and new people, and just growing up as a teenager. And now when I look back, I think there was really a deep connection between this aquarium, the experience of looking at this aquarium and seeing fish moving around, and, you know, like it's an artificial environment, an aquarium, and you have this drone, like this drone sound of filtering equipment that you have. And it was I remember it as a very meditative moment, you know, that you might not think about at first as a sonic experience, more like maybe as a visual thing, but actually I think it's a very deep listening moment where you're trying to connect with this other form of life that you're, you know, taking care of, but also is telling you things, you know, in the way that they behave, and you're in this sound bubble. And so that's how I started sound. I realized recently, I think that was really the sort of seeding moments of what I'm doing now with sound, which is to try and connect further with other species, you know, and try to listen beyond the human way of listening and understand what communication and producing sound or listening for another species might mean. So I studied music, as I said. I went into sound engineering because of this instrument, the electric guitar. I was like, how does it work? You know, and it's really not intuitive, actually. It's already electromagnetism. You have to understand magnets and inductions and things like this. And so I was just curious of, you know, if I play an instrument, and I really wanted to do this for my whole life at the time, I need to understand how the instrument works. So it took me into physics, and so a bit of science, and then sound engineering, and really learning the craft of recording sounds and engaging with sounds in all sorts of ways, you know, music, sort of radio practice, sound for cinema, things like this. And then it just became a big mess of interests that was gravitating around sound. And just to finish on that, I think I, until late, didn't really phrase, articulate in my head the idea or the desire to develop an arts practice. And it's just when I moved to the UK for also a bit intuitively, you know, just to try something different, that, you know, the culture that relates to sound and to being an artist was really different from where I grew up in France, much more inviting in a way, less serious about it, more like try things and then we see. And I really needed that, you know, rather than just overthinking everything. And so that's where I developed a practice that basically was allowing me to explore all sorts of different subject with audio. So yeah, step by step, but it took a long way to understand, you know, what I wanted to do with listening and sound.
Thank you, Antoine, for diving deeper back in time in this beautiful and poetic aquarium, source of an early inspiration of yours. You transform raw data and field recordings into audio meditations that connect us to the living world. Can you walk us a bit through your process? I'm curious how you go from an idea to a finished piece.
Yes. So yeah, very interesting point, because this idea of translating data into sound came as a way I was trying to bridge my interest in science and science related ideas with my interest for sound and music. And the process of taking scientific data or data in general to make music with it or to be able to hear it really came as this this way to connect the two worlds. And so I've used this process, and I still today use it very much in different ways, you know, to explore new subjects. So the process of translating data into sound, which is often called sonification, so like data visualization, but with audio, it's much more common than we think. Actually, it's a bit of a weird word, but we have it every day around us, everywhere. Like if you take public transport, for example, you will often hear signals to warn you of things like the doors are closing, you know, and you hear this tone before that happens. And it's just sometimes it's called auditory display as well as sonification. It's just a way to display information in a way that you can hear. And in many contexts, it's more practical than seeing it. You know, if the door is closing, you don't want to show some flashing other signals to people. You just want to make them aware and that they focus on their not getting stuck in the door, basically. So just to say, it's much more common than we think, but obviously there's a very different way to approach this, which can be much more artistic and convoluted. So when I take a data set and I translate it into sound, the first thing I'm trying to do is to get a feel for what the data is trying to understand or to show. So usually it's quite a few discussion with scientists that I get the data from. Quite a lot of these discussion is like, how are you going to give me the data? In the best case scenario, you get a spreadsheet, like a power, a spreadsheet, sorry. So something very boring, basically, that you start from and you need to code around. Sometimes it's worse, you don't even get a spreadsheet and you have to embark on a journey of interfacing weird scientific software with more creative tools. But so I take this data and then I try some sounds that, you know, trying to come up with a concept basically that's in tune with what the data I might be trying to do. So for example, I, a few years ago, worked, and there was a collaboration with a space observatory located in the Atacama Desert called ALMA. And the scientists were studying stellar winds, which are, you know, very different from Earth wind, which is movement of air. But it was movement of particles and gas in very far away in the universe. And so, yeah, I was trying to find a way to take this data and make it hearable in a way that would make sense. And I use a mix between wind sounds and some sort of meditation bowl, the frequency of which would be tuned by the velocity of the wind in question, to try and experience these winds from space. So yeah, there's this sort of practical conceptual approach, and then you build a composition from it. And at one point, often you realize, well, it's great, but it doesn't sound very musical or engaging. And what do we do then? And I think people work in very different ways with this. Sometimes the data is just an impulsion and it becomes something else, like a pop song, even just an inspiration. And so people really get, stuck with the idea that, it should be the data and just the data and no level of interpretation. I think I'm a bit in between. I'm trying to make the data engaging on a sensory, on an emotional level, but I'm always careful that, if you want to do so as a listener, you can trace back your way back to the raw data in a way. So yeah, I'm trying to give life to data, and that's sometimes why I'm using also analog instruments or devices that have a life on their own, like accidents. You put the data into, for example, a guitar or an analog synthesizer. It's not always gonna sound like the digital world. Sometimes it's gonna vibrate in a way that's unexpected. So that's the kind of thing that we're really receptive to as humans, the life inside sound itself and instruments. So yeah, so that's how I try to navigate this process of going from, the data to a finished piece. And usually I try to then stage this listening experience into something you can go to, like, so basically an installation that you can go to and listen and, almost become more of a cinematic experience where you will listen in particular conditions of light or set design. I don't work so much with just sharing the sound itself, but I like also to sort of curate or design the listening moment. So that would be the last stage of bringing this data to the ears of happy customers.
Antoine, let's dive into some specific underwater sounds that we would like to share with our audience. What is drawing you right now to capturing the sonic world beneath the surface? And what story or sensation do you hope listeners take away when they hear those sounds? For example, those featured in this episode.
Yeah, in many ways, I'm quite new to underwater sounds. Like, I really. So, for example, this radio show I'm doing on ATS Radio is called Edge of the Forest. And so it's just a trace of how land-based I've been when I started with sound. And so that's, I was saying earlier, now I realize the connection between sound and this aquarium, for example, that was in my bedroom. It's like, for now, ocean is the new listening horizon. And it is because it's not, I'm just like everybody, it's like we know now that there are sounds in the ocean and they're wonderful, but it's also for a long time people thought there was no sound, like the world of silence. When Cousteau and his team started scuba diving and devising the techniques to do so, it was assumed that the ocean was silent. And the reason for that is that our ear as human is not adapted for listening underwater. It's unable to really perceive the sound, and when it does, because we do hear some things with the naked ear, it's completely lost in space. We don't know where the sounds are coming from, and that's because the physical properties of sound in water and water are very different from land. But what's also surprising is that as bad as we listeners, underwater listeners as we are, sound is much more agile in ocean. It goes faster, it goes further. It's the opposite of light. If you want, light in the ocean disappears after 20, 30 meters, and then it's darkness. Sound doesn't have this problem. It's ubiquitous in oceans. And it's the opposite on land. So we are light-based terrestrial animal, I guess. And sound is actually not so good, but thinking of something that doesn't travel so well in the atmosphere that we live in, we're actually, there's so much we can do with sound as humans. So imagine in the ocean what, you know, other species do and what we could imagine if we became more tuned with this environment. So that's the first reason why I got interested in underwater sound. But before I maybe say some things about the particular recordings that I think people will hear in this podcast, after this first observation that, wow, there's a world I didn't imagine was so vast that could be explored with ears, something that really transformed my perspective of sound in general, and even more so in the ocean, was a book by author, researcher Karen Backer called The Sounds of Life. And it's a book that's looking into the intersection of artificial intelligence related technique and bioacoustics. So basically having machines analyze the sounds, and in particular the communications of other species, through, you know, something that's an opportunity to renew our way of seeing some of the sounds. You know, you listen to the communication of whales, for example, as a human or a fish. You listen as a human in the same frequency spectrum, and you assume that the way, or it's very hard to get away from it anyway, you assume that the way they're communicating somehow might be similar to the way we do, you know, with a voice modulating pitch, and, you know, but not really. And what machines can do is to bring, I think, another perspective potentially, and also to be able to go somehow deeper into the data and find patterns that we were not able to perceive, or we didn't have the time as a human to excavate. You know, machines are capable to analyze data sets that a single human wouldn't be able to even start listening to in one lifetime because it's too long, you know, things like this. And so, yeah, there is, for me, that's just triggered a whole, it was a bit of a revelation. And I was like, wow, maybe, so this is a new horizon of listening, is to understand further, connect further with what it means to listen for another species and what they might be saying. And so, yeah, that's how I got interested in picking up sounds that, you know, could be forms of communication, and trying to find ways to, you know, create artwork and participate in research that help us understand what is being said. There's a lot of interesting work on whales, for example, and their fascinating sounds. But personally, I got also interested, maybe back to that aquarium again, always, in smaller species that have equivalent levels of refinement in the sounds that they can produce, and how they might be structures, etc. But I a little bit overlooked. Fish species. So, for example, last summer, I at night on the occasion of a dive at night, I was able to record the sound of a scorpion fish in the Mediterranean. Not just one, actually, a whole community of scorpion fish, and it's fascinating. As soon as the sun goes down, they start, I don't want to say singing or chanting because it's kind of a human-like word, but, you know, it's the kind of sound it makes you think of. And it lasts for the whole night and then sort of fades out in the morning. And it's even more intense when it's the full moon, and it's completely fascinating. So it's this kind of idea that, you know, there's much more to the than the human ear can perceive in the ocean that we know of, and that beyond that, it's possible that it's intelligible communication that we might be able to understand. It's just completely crazy. And so that's my motivation these days, to, you know, dive into the ocean, is to you know, really try to, that as human we can make progress in appreciating these sounds and enrich our knowledge or our understanding of our planet, really.
Beautifully said, Antoine. The underworld is a mesmerizing orchestra indeed. How sound and technology are shifting our perspective in relation to the natural world?
So just the point I wanted to make on technology, because I, you know, we talk about machine learning and fancy computing enabling us to understand the communication potentially of other species. I think what I want to say on this and being, you know, in these different ecosystems, sometimes with this machine, you know, is a reminder of is that technology is also natural in some way. You know, the fact that, for example, on a computer screen, I see something is photons that, you know, are being made possible by powering these circuits. These circuits are made of metals that were excavated from long processes, you know, within the earth. Energy initially was, you know, came from the sun, sometimes directly, sometimes because it was eaten by plants millions of years ago, and then these plants died and they went in the underground and they transformed into petrol, and then we went to get it, and this caused a lot of problems. But the point is obvious, is that any technology we have around comes from earth and space. Natural processes, we are not making anything. And so I think what I'm trying to do, and this is something I'm observing, you know, is kind of shifting, and it's at this intersection of like science, arts, advocacy for the ocean, is that we're realizing with, you know, being well within climate change crisis, that it's not just about the scientific facts. Unfortunately, we know the facts since a long time. We progress with the facts of knowing that, you know, the climate change is human induced, and that we are having a massive impact on environments that are really put at risk of disappearing. But not much is changing. It's not just about the facts, unfortunately. In fact, it's, you know, the people that have probably other interests for climate change to stay in this, you know, action to stay in this sort of limbo, have no shame in just making other stories, you know, that would just work against it, you know. And so the reason I was giving this example with technology, and it's all about stories, you know, and I'm sort of realizing at one point I got a bit demotivated with ideas such as what is an artwork going to change in this concept? Now, we need tangible solution, etc., and we need mass change, not, you know, an artwork that a few people would see, etc. As I go and realize that, you know, any micro contribution I think is important, but it's shaping the story is much more important than I thought. And when I say story, it means multiple things, and I think having a sort of profound experiential sensorial connection with nature, with another species, with an ecosystem that feels meaningful, is what I'm trying to sculpt and make happen. It's almost like trying to create these new rituals that, you know, are stronger than the other narratives that, to be honest, are not very good narratives, but they're just, you know, filled with anger and provocation, and they work, you know, on this very instinct level. So how do we compete with this, you know? And so this is one of the changes I'm seeing, and I'm trying to bring a particle of input to, is how do we, you know, shape these stories, and how fiction, even that might be science fiction, you know, that seems like probable within a scientific context, you know, I'm really interested in science and starting from there, but how do we sculpt these sort of new rituals and new ways to appreciate other species in a way, you know, as an individual, as a community, that makes you, you know, dedicating enough, energetic enough, in a position to be a carer for these environments. So that's what I mean by ritual. It's something that you would actually do every Friday or every day or every month, you know, that you find the desire as a human to commit with this engagement.
Storytelling is fundamental indeed. We are so excited that we are here with you at the United Nations Ocean Conference. So I would like to ask you, within the framework of the ocean decade, what have you observed so far in terms of using critical ocean knowledge and data in general, cross-sectoral collaborations for ocean sustainability that we can also see at your work displayed at the exhibition at Villa Arson, Becoming Ocean.
I think there's a realization of the importance of this from scientists I speak to, you know, which maybe 10 years ago they were much more reluctant into going into any sorts of speculation and story, and you know, it's like I'm doing the science, and then I think everybody sees, you know, or is just frustrated with the how unfortunately the fact that it doesn't go very far anymore because of the other annoying team that's trying to, you know, to blind everybody. And so, yeah, so for example, the project we're doing at Villa Arson for the UN Ocean Conference, I think is one iteration of this. You know, we are in the context of a conference that brings many scientists, many institutions, maybe like a lot of decision makers, and have the chance to bring an example in this context, an exhibition, an artwork in this context. And an artwork that's been developed in collaboration with an NGO, with a foundation called Tara Ocean, which is a scientific foundation primarily. And we've been, you know, sort of intuitively, since I went on a residency with them, trying to work on, you know, what's in their work when they are back on land. And they start working with their data, scientific data, and their findings on advocating for ocean, you know, what can bring a people to change their mind, whether it's the public or it's something that has an actual, you know, more direct, as an elected person, a more direct impact on some legislation that may change things over. And I think a lot of people go on their boat, for example, it's a beautiful sailing boat, and they realize at this point the magic of this, and they change this thing. And I think equivalently the artwork that we are trying to produce together can change this. So in a few words, sorry, I'm speaking a bit too much maybe. The artwork is a simple artwork. It's a puddle shaped glass interface. It's made of material that are but in a way share something with the ocean, you know, glass and sand, but you know, the primary goal was to make something that could be through digital processes, but cut in any place or compact enough that it could be transported without becoming this big weight and logistics to carry around. So this is something that the Tara Foundation can bring anywhere. And the glass bottle interface is reflecting sounds and visuals from underwater and trying to bring people in this sort of meditation space with another species and to create a place where potentially, this is in the context of an exhibition that will last several months. In the last exhibition, I got a lot of feedback from people that were coming back to the exhibition to spend a bit of time with that meditation room and space that put them in touch with the other species. Playing the sounds from species at, you know, very different scales in the ocean, from plankton, like really invisible microscopic species, but that also communicate, and you can also hear what they're might be speaking about through a process of sonification, to fish and maybe, you know, in the future other species. At Villa Arson, it will be presented in the form of a small itinerary, like something you can walk through, which will be between the inside of the gallery space and outside. And the hope is that, it works a bit as a public space where you can go. And this is kind of the long-term vision, no? That you can create these artworks that would be more like, you know, like you have these statues or monuments in cities available to the public, but, you know, that would be dedicated to ocean and to spending time in the presence of the sensorialities, the intelligences of other species, a little bit like a sort of small, temple. Almost. I don't want to get too religious. It's not about belief, you know, but, you know, having these gathering places of gathering where you can express and connect with these other species, although sometimes they are far, and importantly gather as group of people, as citizens together in these sort of spaces. So Villa Arson would be a bit of a prototype of this, but you know, publicly available and outside, and you know, anybody can come and listen anytime during these few months of the exhibition.
Thank you, Antoine. It was a real pleasure to explore your work and the powerful ways you connect sound, science, and storytelling. Your perspective adds such depth to the dialogue around how we listen to and engage with the world. We are truly excited about the possibility of future collaborations and can't wait to share what's coming next with our audience.